Welcome to Rooster Radio. I'm Andrew Montesi with James Begley. We're back after what we're calling an early Christmas break. Thanks for sticking with us. As you know, we talk to interesting people doing amazing things, and this couldn't be more true for our guest, Dr. Elaine Stead. Elaine is Head of Venture Capital at Blue Sky Investments, which includes overseeing South Australia's $50 million VC fund. More broadly, Blue Sky manages $3 billion worth of investments across infrastructure, real estate, and private equity. A lot of people think of VCs as khaki-wearing white men with a godlike ability to giveth and taketh away. Elaine breaks the VC mold with complete authenticity, unafraid to share not only her insights and opinions, but also her vulnerabilities on social media and blogs. Elaine is open about her story, mental health challenges, and taboo issues, which she admits may be confronting for investors and her stakeholders. But little by little, she's changing the culture of her industry. While the world of venture capital is seemingly driven by numbers, we have an in-depth conversation about the humanistic side of founders, startups, and business, and the human cost of entrepreneurship. We also talk about her own pathway. Before venture capital, Elaine was a stem cell biologist and also a startup founder. Enjoy our chat with Dr. Elaine Stead. Elaine, welcome to Rooster Radio.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
I have to read a quote from you because this is going to kick off interview because I think it's a brilliant quote.
You're probably wondering which quote.
Yeah.
There's a fair bit out there, but this one for me resonated really strongly. And you said the link between learned persistence and patience and confidence is drawn far too rarely. For me, that just like stood out. Can you discuss your thoughts when writing that?
God, where do I start? So in every Blue Sky office, actually, probably I'll take you out after we finish this podcast and show you, there is a quote from Calvin Coolidge about persistence, and I'm not going to quote it because I can't, but basically the quote talks about how talent isn't sufficient, smarts are not sufficient. The thing that really stands the test of time is persistence. And one thing I've really noticed over the last two decades, or even like my whole life, but certainly watching founders in a more concentrated manner over the last decade, the thing that is the most useful trait, I think, is that tendency towards persistence, and that you can actually learn that, right? Like some people do have that innately, but I think people underestimate that that's just something you can learn to do over time, and that the very act of being persistent and actually sort of seeing some rewards at the end of it is what gives a lot of people confidence, and that's a virtuous cycle. And I just think it's underestimated.
And confidence doesn't normally play into those two traits, though, does it? I mean, persistence and patience, your confidence is tested constantly, so...
But when you persist through something that's really tough and you actually then kind of break through, that's the most amazing feeling ever. Like when stuff comes too easily to you, I think that's – I actually think a lot of people who are actually super smart or they're super athletically gifted or whatever it is that, you know, they were born with and it comes so easily to them, they're the ones who have the least amount of confidence. And yet I think the very act of kind of breaking through something that's really tough, challenging yourself and getting through it to the end is the thing that really gives that sort of sense of confidence. You know that you can actually face a whole bunch of challenges that will get thrown in your way.
We've got a lot of things to unpack, but if you're going to just pull out either one of your own, I guess, moments where you felt like you've broken through or one of potentially some of your founders that have experienced it, is there a highlight, one that stands out?
For myself, I think every time I've started a new venture, because I consider myself an entrepreneur, and I know that probably sounds a bit weird as a venture capitalist now, but I really feel like I've had three entrepreneurial projects. So the first was my PhD, and I know that's a weird thing to say, but you really are given a stipend to study somewhere in a lab, and you are required to just develop your own hypothesis. You then have to test it yourself. You've got to come up with the resources yourself. That's very similar to the entrepreneurial journey that we see a lot of our founders go through. The second was the startup, that that I had here in Adelaide, which was reproductive health science. First time I'd ever run a business myself. People's salary were depending on me, and, you know, we had a single mother with four kids working for us. So, you know, that sort of stuff. Every time I find myself in a situation where I've got no idea what I'm doing, but actually I get there in the end, that's kind of the things that stand out for me. But I think in terms of the founders that I've worked with, there are so many examples, and like I wouldn't want to necessarily single anyone out, but I think of the Vino Mofo guys. So Andre and Justin, you know, they had so many false starts with Vino Mofo as a business.
Because the headlines that you see just seems to be like it just keeps going, getting better and better, and it's all just rolled out for them.
That's the myth of this whole sector, isn't it? And it's part of the problem, right? Because people don't talk about the hard stuff. They talk about, you know, when they've been successful. And actually the Andre and Justin do a really good job of actually talking about the fact that it hasn't been a straight line from where they started to where they've ended up. But, you know, they had a business that first started out as like a wine review business, and then they turned it into a retail business, but it wasn't really what they wanted to build. It was more of a discounted wine offering, and then they sold that business to Capture the Day, and they really regretted that decision. So there's been a number of false starts. But even before that, like Justin has been bankrupt previously, and, you know, Andre's had his own challenges as well. And I know there is a screening of the new Hustle Tonight here in Adelaide, and like if you're going to go along to that, I recommend it, because there's this one scene with Andre's wife Jodie, and she is just in absolute tears about how hard it was at the start, how much Andre had asked her to just have faith in him, and they couldn't pay their bills, and, you know, that stuff is the real stuff, the real kind of entrepreneurial journey. And that's always super inspiring to see that founders can kind of push through that. And it's not just the founders, their families as well, right? Their families have to endure all of that hard time as well, and they've got less control over the situation than the founder does. So I actually think it's a bit harder for them.
Mm, absolutely. So we've spoken about persistence, patience. You've had your own entrepreneurial journey so far, but you have come to a point where you actually had to leave things that you invested so much into. So you had your PhD qualified as a biochemist to then shift your startup as well. So at what point, when you're looking at persistence and patience, like reconciling that point to go, you know what, I can't do what I'm doing anymore, I need to do something different. What was that for you?
Yeah, so I think the decision to change tack was not because I gave up. Mm-hmm. The decision to change tack was more because I felt like I had done as much as I could do in that particular stream, and actually I was ready for a new challenge to do something else. And in every circumstance when I changed, I was still using all of the great things I'd learnt in that previous chapter. So I still use my PhD today. We look at biomedical and healthcare technologies, and we've invested in some. But more importantly, the analytical skills and the problem-solving skills are the things that come out of that, and I use that every single day. So every time I sort of pivoted, it's not because what I've been doing before has no longer worked and I'm sort of not persisting and giving up. Mm. It's because I actually can see a new path which actually looks super interesting, and I've just had the luxury of being able to chase that down. Mm. You know, I think anyone's kind of path is a combination of their own choices but also a whole bunch of luck. And I've just been very lucky to have been given those opportunities when I wanted to take them.
Whilst we're on the, I guess, this humanistic element of starting things and entrepreneurship, when is it that you detect in yourself that a change is imminent or a change is healthy? What do you notice about yourself?
So in my case, I notice that I've fallen out of love with it. And how do you know you've fallen out of love with something?
You're swearing at it a lot.
No, that actually I think means that I'm still in love with it. Yeah, because, you know, there's that fine line between love and hate. If you've got an emotional reaction to something, I think you're still challenged by it is still in love with it. For me, it's more about I no longer have that burning desire to learn more about what I'm doing in my spare time. So, you know, right now I still, on the weekends, I'm reading stuff about venture or, you know, startups or, you know, the humanistic element behind entrepreneurialism because it so fascinates me still. Whereas I think if I'm no longer that engaged in something, when I'm not actually still trying to learn more about it in my spare time, that's when I've kind of, you're going through the motions, you're not in love with it anymore.
You kind of have to know yourself pretty well, don't you? Because I look at my own journey, I think I've had little dips where I've felt like a bit disconnected from this, but then it picks up again.
Yeah.
So it's like I haven't actually fallen out of love with it. I just might have been going through a flat patch.
Yeah. And I think yes, you have to know yourself, but I think it's a function of time as well. You know, I talk with other members of the Blue Sky private equity team. You know, this is actually a pretty emotionally charged job. And so it can be quite emotionally exhausting. And every one of us have gone through periods where we are just dead on our feet or we're so exhausted that it's really hard to stay super engaged. But it's always a transient thing. And I think that's kind of normal. But if you're feeling disengaged over like a 12-month period, like that to me is a sign for me that it's time to do something else.
What type of toll does the process of starting something take on its founders? What do you notice? And I guess how do you support them in that process?
So the biggest toll that – well, there's a bunch of things that I think it does for founders. So one is there's a personal toll because this is usually an individual's vision, and if it doesn't come off, that's a real confidence leveler, I think. So they've got a lot of their identity tied up in the success of this vision. And I think that's a good thing because that's what drives people to do what they do. But I think there is a toll that is taken on the people around them as well, because either they have to be supportive of that vision, and that's often a benevolent action, I think. But also entrepreneurs are wired to be really single-minded, I think. So if they're single-mindedly focused on building their business, that means they're probably not paying the right sort of attention to their family and their loved ones. And I think that's a really tough thing too. So the thing that I think is highly underestimated or not talked about enough is how being a founder and taking a business through the various ups and downs that it needs to go through on its growth path takes the toll that takes on their human relationships. Because I think that's actually a really tricky path to navigate.
And I guess those relationships are the things that nourish people then when the chips are down, and therefore it is incredibly important that those networks are still, you know, close to home.
Absolutely. And it's the networks that you need when the chips are down, but it's also just the excuse or the opportunity to have something else to focus on outside of this single goal. Because from a mental health perspective, you know, it doesn't matter how focused you are or how dedicated you are, if you don't have some sort of outlet outside of your your business, I think that's when you start to get into area that's a little bit tricky for people and can get them into trouble.
Some people may be surprised that we're talking to a VC and we've been talking about all the personal human aspects. When you're, I guess, introduced to a startup and you're assessing them, how much of the personal v financial, like is there a mix or is it a blend?
It's definitely a mix, but I would say the deal breaker is the people and the human side of it. So we've had a number of companies which had awesome products and huge markets, and I know that had we invested, that would have made money, but the individuals involved were either untrustworthy or unreliable or we weren't quite sure that they shared the same sort of values and ethics that we did. And so we've said no. So the human element is the real deal breaker, but it's definitely a mix. It's not only the people. Needs to have, you know, all the other things that we all talk about, like great products, great growth trajectory, all of that sort of thing. But yeah, the human element is important because we work with them for, like, you know, in the South Australian Venture Fund, it's a 15-year fund. Mm. So I'm going to be 57 years old when that fund is finished. So I've got a long time to work with the people that we're investing in, right? And they want to know that we're a good partner and that they're going to get along with us and vice versa. So that chemistry or alchemy is really important.
So I would imagine that, you know, assessing numbers is one thing, but assessing people, like, how do you actually – how do you pull out their stories and
get
understand?
Them drunk and see what they're doing.
Yeah, see a bit.
We have been known to use that strategy.
Yeah, to uncover, you know, their stories of persistence if it's there and patience and things like that.
Yeah. So, look, I'd love to tell you we've got this really structured process for understanding people, but we don't. We just try to spend a lot of time with people. One of the things that we select for when we bring people onto our investing team is their EQ. Are they good at sort of understanding and reading people? And so I think we can always do better, but we've got a good team with respect to that. And so we just try and spend a lot of time with people and really get to know them. It's one of the reasons why we tell founders to come and see us well before they're actually looking for money or well before they're looking for money from us. So we can spend a lot of time just to get to know them, to work out whether they're good humans, see if they like us and they think they can work with us. And yep, sometimes we get them drunk. Sometimes we just see how they deal with their business over a period of time before we get involved. Like the last investment we made in our second venture fund is a company called Lexa. It's a data platform business based in Melbourne. And the founder of that company is a guy called Dave Whittle. And he first came to see me and pitched three different business ideas and
had a Rolodex of businesses. No, that one didn't work. Right. What about this one?
He's just super prolific. He's really entrepreneurial. And one of those three was Lexa and is still, you know, alive today. And when we actually closed the deal, he rang me that day and he said, you know, it's been 928 days since I first pitched to you, which sounds hideous if you're a founder, but they were too early for us, but we got to know him over time and saw that he said he would do everything he said he would and got to know him as an individual and got a good sense that he was the type of person we wanted to back.
Are there any other examples of, I guess, people or characters that, you know, have played a big part in convincing you to invest in them?
Yeah, so they're co-founders for sure. And often, you know, Australia is not a big place, and, you know, certainly not in Adelaide, but it's true everywhere else, to be honest. There's so few degrees of separation between people that you can almost always get some validation points, which allow you to kind of just cross-check that the way you're thinking about someone is true or not. But yeah, you know, this is super untrendy to say, but we absolutely trust our gut on that stuff. And I think the reason why we can trust our gut is because for 11 years, we've had this exact same approach. And not every company has knocked it out of the park, but I feel like we could give a name of any one of the founders that we've backed and they will say that that's an approach that they liked and that they felt supported. So I think we're doing okay. I think we're taking the right approach. But, you know, we're always open to doing things a little bit better too.
Having said all this, I've read an article that you wrote about reasons why startups shouldn't pursue venture capital.
Great headline.
Mm. Yeah, it was a good headline. But also your 10 points were, of course, very true, but quite brutal, I would imagine, for based on what the perceptions are out there about the typical pathway for funding. I don't have those 10 points in front of me because I forgot to print it out.
You don't remember them?
No, I know. I know. I was too shocked. Are you able to just give us a snapshot of perhaps why it isn't the be-all and end-all pathway for a startup?
Look, I think Well, the first thing that's probably worth stating there is that most venture funds are looking for 30% IRR, right? Or, you know, depending how long the fund is, 3 to 5 times money on
that's internal rate of return. And can you just unpack this little topic of actually what that means?
What IRR means? Yeah. It means on an annual basis, what has been the percentage return back to an investor for their, you know, $1 in to the fund. So we typically we're looking for like a 30% IRR.
Even if that's not materially, that's not money, that's the value increase in the business, or that's actually dividends?
No, the goal is at the end of the fund, once you've returned your money back to investors, that that's been their return. So, yeah, it can, at various times during the fund, it can be unrealized as well as realized. But, yeah, I mean, I think if our investors get 3% back on their money at the end of the day, even if during the period of the investment it's been sort of 5, 6, 10 times its money, I think they'll be pretty upset. So that's the goal. And not every business has a growth profile that can support that sort of a return. So those businesses are probably going to be very disappointed by the venture process because they're going to have investors who want them to grow really fast, and that might not be what they want to do with their business. So that's kind of point number one. But I think the second critical point is when you raise money from an institutional investor, then all of a sudden you are absolutely conceding control. Maybe not all of the control, but some of it. And for a lot of entrepreneurs, that they're allergic to that, understandably, right? They want to row their own boat. They want to they've become an entrepreneur because they want to build something themselves. So I would say that the second point of contention that we often see in venture is just that sort of friction between investors and founders on having a say over the key decisions of the company.
Yeah, I mean, what's the response like when you have some of these initial conversations from founders? I mean, is it something that they're aware of? Like, is there a bit of misinformation, do you think, out there about the pathway and about what is to be expected?
I think it varies. So we've had founders who are super clued up about this whole space and know the pros and cons early on. And we've got other founders who, for whom this is their first time ever raising money, and they're probably less across all of the sort of dark elements of raising money. One of the ways we try to address this early on is to really talk about all of those points before we even get to a term sheet. So we're always trying to make sure that everyone is fully informed, and the types of things that we will be looking for if we invest in a company, so that if they're not cool with that, then we're not wasting their time. But also, you know, just trying to help them understand the process as well. That's part of our job. So we have those discussions early on. I think if you talk to any of our founders, they would say that we kind of bring up all of the deal breaker stuff really early, so that we understand everyone's comfortable with it. And
this might sound like a silly question, but on Rooster Radio, we have the luxury of asking really dumb questions to really smart people. What is the mechanics of setting up a VC fund? Like, what everyone talks about, like, how do you go and raise the money required to fund your fund?
It's an excellent question, and it's not talked about enough. I did write a 4-part Medium post on it because I think people don't realize that we do exactly what founders do, right? We're just middlemen, you know. It's not more exciting than that. The mechanics of setting up a fund are really just understanding what structure you want to set up. That could be a limited partnership, it could be a trust, it could be a whole bunch of different sort of legal structures. And then it's about trying to develop the strategy that you think makes the most sense, and then developing some material that reflects that. So like a founder produces a pitch deck, so do we. In our case at Blue Sky, because we have a lot of wholesale investors as well, we also have to do information memorandums. So that's a, you know, 120 page exercise. And then we go out and market it to investors. And in our case, we have a mix of both institutional investors and wholesale investors. And the difference between those two, wholesale investors are individuals. They're categorized as wholesale investors if they have over 2 million in assets and 250,000 a year in income. Whereas institutional investors, when I say that, I'm referring mostly to big superannuation funds. And we have both in our funds. And we just have to pitch to them.
So in that process, do you and your business partner draw up a massive hit list in the beginning and start like ringing up and doing coffees, or do you do boardroom presentations, or
how does all of the above?
So, how long did that take?
So we've been raising our fourth venture fund for 12 months to get to – we just marketed to wholesale investors, and – it took us 12 months to get to first close with our wholesale investors, and now we're marketing to institutional investors, and I suspect that'll take another 6 months, maybe more. So it's a, you know, a two-year process. It's not for the faint-hearted. I think I have – in the last year I have given 300 pitches, but in the year before that, before we actually formally launched, I probably gave the same. So it's sometimes coffees, it's sometimes – boardroom presentations, it's sometimes ballroom presentations, right? Sometimes we actually get up in a conference room in a hotel and have 50 people come and pitch to them that way as well. So
how do you maintain the energy in what you're saying? Because you're saying the same type of thing over and over again, and you must go, oh, I'm fucking sick of this.
Look, yes, of course. Everyone gets...
It's like Paul McCartney recently, like a couple of nights ago, and he's probably thinking, I've got to sing these stupid songs again.
I imagine, yeah, I'm sure I'm exactly like Paul McCartney. Look, yes, it's tiring to give the same presentation over and over again, or to talk about the same thing over and over again. I'm not going to lie. But the reason you kind of persist, or the reason I persist, is because I fundamentally believe in what we're doing. So, very much like an entrepreneur, I think you have that ability to keep going and going and going, because you just think, if I do this enough, I'm going to get through eventually. And we will, right? I just love it. So if you love what you're doing and you think there's some purpose and you've got some meaning out of it as well, I think you can just kind of battle through it. I mean, it's a first world problem, honestly. Like,
oh, another yes. Coffee.
Yeah,
oh,
exactly.
Another glass of champagne with a high net worth. Well, you've just nailed
totally.
It.
Totally.
So on that, what does a typical week look like for you then?
So I won't describe this week, because this week has been very untypical. Or maybe I will describe this week.
But, yeah, but also in the context of what you told us before we started recording.
Yeah.
So what I told the guys before we started recording was that this week in Adelaide has been the longest stretch of time I've spent in a city since May, and that's been 5 days. So so what did I do? Okay, I got to Adelaide on Sunday. We had a board meeting here on Monday morning, did our board meeting, went with the board to the cricket.
Yes. Good.
Which sounds like it was just you know, an afternoon of skiving off, and there was certainly skiving off for sure. But, you know, the cricket at Adelaide, everyone is there. So we saw all of these people that we are kind of doing various bits of business with. So that was great from a networking perspective. Tuesday I had origination meetings all day, so new businesses that were coming to pitch to us who were trying to understand what the South Australian Venture Fund was about. And then Tuesday night, I had dinner with my mates and we watched cricket. Wednesday, again, we did some origination meetings. I had another board meeting that I dialed into. I had some internal meetings. So one of the things we try to do with the team is do one-on-ones every 2 weeks. So did some of those, because part of the challenge of this business, particularly as we're all spread out everywhere, is just trying to make sure everyone's connected and feels like a team and knows what's going on. Yesterday I went and gave a talk to Startup Adelaide about all of the awesome things that we've been doing in South Australia over the last year. And also I'm on the board of Startup Oz, so the Crossroads report was released a month ago, so I talked about some of the findings of that, strengths and weaknesses. And then today I'm talking to you guys. I'm seeing a new company at lunchtime. I'm going to talk to PwC about helping to develop the digital economy policy soon. And then I'm going home.
What I guess didn't feature in the last week was airports.
Which is so nice, I have to say. Look, again, first world problem, flying everywhere, but most of our companies are in nowhere in particular. So we've got investee companies in Brisbane, in Sydney, in Melbourne, in Adelaide, in Bangkok, in Singapore, in Minneapolis, in San Francisco, and in New York. So if, given what we try to do is active management, and that requires a lot of face time, it means there's a lot of time on planes. Plus, we're fundraising still. So that's the reason for, you know, the ridiculous amount of travel over the last 6 months in particular.
I saw you write another article about, I guess, the reflective aspects of airports and travel, and I completely agree. And sometimes those moments can be euphoric, and sometimes those moments can be highly depressing. How do you sort of find the alone time?
Oh,
with travel?
The complete spectrum. So there's been times when I've been on a plane or in an airport and I have just been sobbing because, like, it's, I don't know what it is about planes, but it really just, it can inspire some really extreme reactions. And I've talked to a lot of people about this, and I'm not alone, and it's not because I'm a girl, because I've talked to so many men who've said they love long-haul flights and they put on, like, some soppy movie and they'll cry, which they won't do, like, in their normal day or life. So there's something about maybe the atmosphere change or something on a plane. But
And I think if you've got an attachment to home, like, I think if you love your home too, that departure from home just causes
it's a trigger.
Emotions.
Definitely.
One way or the other. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can take on the world and, who am I? I'm just a small bit on a very big machine.
Exactly. Totally.
Yeah.
So I've had those reactions. I've had reactions where I, as you said, sort of euphoric, more like, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm doing this amazing thing. I can't believe someone pays me to do this amazing thing. You know, so you have those reactions as well, but and everything in between. But it's part of the job. I signed up for it. I whinge about it enough on Twitter. So that's my vent.
Well, on that, what role does social media and your kind of prolific blogging, what role does that play for you?
So Twitter initially was a platform that I found super useful for aggregating news. So I'm a prolific reader, and I just found by cultivating the right sort of people that I would follow, it meant all that news just came into my news feed. And then it sort of evolved to finding people who were interested in the same things that you were interested in. So more from an ideas or a industry sector perspective. And then it sort of evolved into a way to keep a tab on how other people who I don't agree with feel about things. So, you know, I've made a conscious effort to try and not set up an echo chamber in my Twitter account. And then it's like just a useful platform for me to just kind of, I do a lot of traveling on my own. So I kind of, if I need to, the types of things I would otherwise say to someone I was sitting next to or traveling with, I just say to Twitter. And it feels like it delivers the same outcome for me. And also I just get a whole bunch of interaction as a result of it.
Is it
and I really enjoy that. Mate, yeah, probably. Cause I'm a massive introvert actually. So
no.
Yes.
Really?
Yes. Yes. Meaning I need a lot of time alone, and, I find Twitter is an excellent way to be alone, but interact with people on my terms. like I can respond, I cannot respond, whatever. So I very much enjoy it for that reason. The writing side, the writing came from an idea that I had from a psychologist. So I had a bout of depression last year, which made me start to go see a psychologist as well as a GP with medication. And one of the things that came out of that interaction was that I really struggle with anxiety as well. And one of the symptoms of my anxiety, well, one of the manifestations of my anxiety is I've just got this hamster wheel in my head all the time, just obsessing about things I shouldn't be obsessing about and kind of getting caught on a loop and just playing over and over and over again. And so she recommended just putting my thoughts down on paper as a way to just kind of get it out of your head and put it onto paper, which I did. And I literally haven't stopped. It's funny. I started that process and I definitely think it has helped on the anxiety front, but it's now just like, it's like diarrhea. Like it is literally just pouring out of me and I can't stop. So
the thing that I love about and only diving briefly into some of the stuff that you've done, but is it's so real and so vulnerable. And I see business is all about power and it's all about barriers and facades. And you manage to be real in a world where that's usually seen as a weakness. Why would you invest money in someone who might be impressive or anxious?
Sure.
You know, we need someone who's 100% confident and they're just going to win.
Stable.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we all know it's bullshit, but you've managed to carve out a mechanism to be you. So, has it always been easy?
No, is the short answer. So maybe I'll address your first comment first.
Sorry, so, there are a few there.
No, it's okay. So you're right. I think some people think that business is about power or it's about facades, but actually business is about people, particularly this business. And so when it's about people, everyone's got an antenna up for insincere behavior or non-authentic words. And so I think there is actually a lot of power in being yourself and being authentic, even if what you're saying can be construed as being negative. I think by being so open about my challenges, it means when I say something to somebody, they're pretty confident I'm telling the truth, because what would be my motivation for lying, or what would be my motivation for not telling the truth? So I think it has helped on that, in that perspective. And I think people want to know that they can, fuck up and it's not going to be the end of the world. And I think hopefully a lot of my founders know that I can empathize with their challenges because I'm so public about my challenges as well. And basically what I'm doing by writing about those things is I'm writing about them, essentially asking the world to be okay with it, and which they mostly are. And so I think what the founders see is that they can then do that with me, hopefully. Definitely. I've definitely noticed that, and they've made that comment themselves. So that's why I think, you know, business really is about people, and you want to deal with people you like and that you can trust, and hopefully this has helped with that. It's definitely not always been positive. Overwhelmingly, the feedback has been positive. And when I say that, I mean people are grateful that someone else can be public about something that they themselves would like to be public about. I think it does, just every little bit helps everyone else have less of a stigma about it. But, you know, I'm a director of a public company, which is Blue Sky, and I can see why it would make people nervous, because, okay, this person's got a mental health issue. Does that mean they can't do their job properly? And I'm an investor in that business, and does that give me faith that they're actually managing their fiduciary duties appropriately? And, you know, I wrote a long post about how I don't believe my mental health issues have any impact on that whatsoever. In fact, I actually think it has a positive impact on my ability to do my job. But I can understand why that's a concern.
I've come from a world of sport, and the interesting thing about is sport probably started to change the perception of this about 10 years ago. It wasn't straight away. To the point now in the AFL, you know, it's fairly, I say it is common for a player to maybe check out. They've got some things they've got to deal with, and there's not much of a backlash.
Mm.
Business world, the bravado still seems a bit more archaic, and so it's interesting. And I think it's great that you're kind of cracking that open a little bit, but it feels a bit more early days compared to even sport, which used to be the macho landscape.
I think it is because notwithstanding that sport is still a business in many ways and people's livelihoods are dependent on it, it's still seen predominantly as entertainment, whereas what we do, the only objective is to make people money. And so when it comes down to money, people are less – yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, I think the other tricky part is I work in a sector where there is already just so little, like, gender diversity or ethnic diversity. Like, it's pretty much white males as far as the eye can see, which is, you know, great.
Andrew's got Italian heritage.
Yeah. But so they're already – they've already struggled to accept differences. And so to kind of ask them to say, like, accept me and also I've got all these issues as well, as well as just being, like, not like the rest of you guys, I think, you know, has been a tall order. But by and large, everyone has responded really positively. No one's asked me to resign yet, so.
So has there been a professional cost along the way?
Probably, but I mightn't be aware of it. So I think if someone were to read my blogs or follow me on Twitter and come to the conclusion that I'm not the right person to back, I probably will never know about it. But what I do know is there have been a number of key people in this industry who have reached out to me privately and sort of patted me on the back for it. And that's wonderful.
It's the kind of thing, though, that actually changes culture. Like when you look at the business to say this person is authentic, they're real, you know, people aren't always going to like what she's going to say, but we're going to back her in.
Mm.
Like that's actually – that stuff changes culture.
Totally. And, you know, culture is a big thing for us. I mean, every company says that culture is a big thing for them. But we have always had a culture at Blue Sky of once you're in the Blue Sky team, then we put our arms around you. You're one of us. Like, you have all the support you need, whether that was, you know, illness or whether it was family issues or whatever it is. Like, we do that, and we try to not just – we don't just say that. We exemplify it as well. And for us, culture is very much an example-driven is reinforced by examples. So we try to lead by example. And I feel like Blue Sky in particular have been incredibly tolerant and understanding and forgiving and supportive of me.
I'm going to jump back into more of some of the kind of mechanical questions about investment. And, like, we didn't really want to focus.
Mate, don't get too boring.
No, no, we're enjoying the humor. There are going to be a lot of people who are going to be a little bit interested.
Don't ask about internal rate of returns and all that sort of stuff again.
Let's say you've got an idea or you've got an early stage business. You know, you can just be really brief here, but like rough, like, is it amount of turnover that you might be looking for, number of users? At what point do you jump in in the ecosystem? Really
yeah,
early
sure.
Or a bit further down the track?
A bit further down the track. So we say we're late stage venture investors, which means different things to different people. But for us, it means that a company has usually been in the market for a year or two by the time we invest. So products developed or the platform or the services developed, there's no more technology risk. The business model has been validated and it's just about scale up. The team that we've assembled at Blue Sky in our venture business here in Adelaide, but also in Brisbane, is we're not technology experts. We're the expertise everyone has is really around scaling businesses up. So how do we increase market share domestically? How do we open new channels to international export markets? How do we increase operational efficiency? How do we accelerate the path to profitability? That's the skill set that we bring to the table. It's quite different to most venture funds, because most venture funds are focused on early stage, right? You have to have a technology background or domain expertise. And it's one of the reasons why we have been able to invest across a whole bunch of different sectors. So e-commerce and software and food and logistics, and because the skills are the same, but they're just not commonly found in venture funds.
The sort of earliest you've invested in something, like what was the turnover or what was the number of views, or just an idea, because there are going to be people sitting here go, oh, you know, how far away is it
from Yeah. So we have invested in pre-revenue businesses before, and that the first one that we did that wasn't healthcare was a spectacular failure. So that's the exception that proves the rule. But in terms of our sweet spot, I think the earliest we've invested has been around a $2 million revenue run rate.
You've kind of killed my flow a little bit, because I want to come back to some of the mental health side of things. Like, because what I'm interested in is the ability, like mental health challenges, yes, but then the ability to continue to perform at a high level. So how do you have a system? How do you manage yourself to be able to look after yourself, but also continue to perform at that high level?
Yeah, sure. Excellent question. So the first answer is pharmaceutical intervention. I take an antidepressant, and that has absolutely made a huge difference. And I wrote a blog about that actually, and the effects that I thought that had, both positive and negative. I also write, which I think has made a huge difference as well. Sleep is incredibly important. Not just as someone who has mental health issues, just as someone who needs to perform at a high level, I would recommend everyone who is in a job that requires a lot of concentration or high performance on a consistent basis, that they focus on sleep, because that has fundamentally, I think, made a bigger performance difference than anything else. I have recently started taking nicotine, which has helped with the early starts and, you know, making sure I'm
So not to get off smoking?
No, as a nootropic.
Oh, you're kidding?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So kids, anyone listening, don't try that at home.
And is it a patch or a tablet or?
Tablet. Yeah, nicotine, the Nicorettes. Yeah. This is not sponsored by Nicorette, by the way. and then it's really just about making sure I have enough downtime. So, you know, because I am an introvert, like today I'm going to go home tonight, and tomorrow I'm going to speak to no one, and I'm going to do my washing before I get on a plane on Sunday. So I really need that sort of time. And then the last but the like super most important part of that entire high performance regime has been my teammates. So, you know, I work with 11 guys in our team who are amazing, but in particular at the sort of senior level, I've got one or two teammates who are just like rocks in the sense that we reach out to each other when we've got something that we're struggling with, either professionally or personally, and just like kind of swap stories about that stuff and help each other navigate it. And I think that is what helps us sustain that, because you need to know other people are going through the same things that you are, and you also just need a bit of human connection and you need some advice. So that's been really important.
When you do disconnect, I mean, apart from doing your washing, what are some other things that really take your mind where it needs to go?
Oh, I'm going to sound super lame, but I sing.
Sing?
Yeah. So I have tried a whole bunch of meditations, not for me, tried it so many times. And every time I say that, someone who's totally into meditation just says, oh, but you haven't tried hard enough. But it's not for me. I used to play a lot of sport, and sport was very much a release for me. But I've had two knee operations and a hip operation. Sport's not on the cards for me anymore, unfortunately. But I have always sung, and I find singing incredibly meditative. Like, the only thing I'm thinking about at that time is the song. And so I do that at home where no one else can hear me. And I find that really relaxing.
Is there a particular song that's your go-to
or genre?
No, there isn't. But like, if I'm feeling really down, like, my mum is a singer as well. So, and we used to sing as a family growing up a lot. So a lot of the things that we sung growing up, I'll kind of revert to.
In this kind of entrepreneurial world, everyone's clamoring to like mirror the right formula, whether it's in the way that you start your business or lean methodology, MVP, all this stuff. And it's the same for performance. You know, you got to hustle, 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 don't sleep, you know. But the ones that seem to have succeeded absolutely just find their own formula. How long do you think it's taken you to find, and you might still be searching, but, you know, how long has it taken? And also, where do you draw your bits and pieces from?
I am definitely still on a work in progress on that front. I definitely know myself better than I did 20 years ago, and so I am kind of trying to find that, my groove. But I learn from the people around me. Everyone reads a whole bunch of books about what you need to do to kind of optimize things. You know, everyone's read Tim Ferriss and, you know, tries to hack that. But I found the most useful nuggets of wisdom have come from people I work with. And, you know, Mark Sowerby was an incredible inspiration for me for the, you know, 5 years that I got to work with him. But all along my career, I've had people who I've thought of as teachers, and they've often done something I've admired, whether it's been professionally successful, but more often had a professional success, but been able to navigate having personal success as well. And so I try to look at what they do and then mirror that in a way that it sort of fits into my life too.
What were some of the things that stood out about Mark in particular?
So on the professional side, I've never met a more determined person, and also a person who was more able to bring a whole bunch of other people with him. He's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. There'll be a whole bunch of people who work for Mark who will be looking at, you know, hearing this podcast with their mouth open going, what? Because he's a hard taskmaster as well. But he had this insane ability to tell stories, and that skill of telling stories is, again, highly underrated, but it's the one way that he was able to bring people, not just the people we work with, but investors to the table and to get excited about what he was building. So I thought that was phenomenal, and I've never met anyone else like that. And at the same time, he's got, you know, he's married, he's got two kids, he always had plenty of time for them. He's retired now to spend 100% of the time with his teenage kids and his wife, who's an amazing triathlete going around the world competing. So, like, you know, the people who are able to find that balance between doing something amazing and building an amazing family at the same time, I just find really admirable.
Have you learned anything major from your founders, like any specifics we've...
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I feel like I learn from them all the time. The fact that they're able to do what they do, and like, I'm trying to think, all of them have families, and the fact that they can give their business the focus and urgency that it needs and still be a good dad or a good girlfriend or a good, you know, husband. Like, I think that stuff I've learnt a lot from, being able to just compartmentalise.
And so you mentioned, I mean, is that also in part, so, I mean, do you reflect on your own world and think, oh, I'm not sure I could juggle those two things?
I certainly couldn't. So I could not do my job if I had a family. And that's not to say others can't, because the guys I work with all have families and seem to cope just fine. But if I think about my travel schedule over the last year, I could not do that if I had kids. And so there would be compromises at different stages, and that would, some of those compromises would probably be family, but a lot of those compromises would be my job. I could still do my job. I just couldn't do it with the same sort of commitment.
Monty and I talk about it all the time. Monty's got two kids. I've got one and one on the way. And, you know, again, the formula with startup is all hustle, 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 you know, single-minded, kind of leave everything else.
I was told it was a drawback because kids are fairly young.
Yeah. And it is a real tension that is not – there's no kind of – there is no balance to it really. You're always one way or the other.
Yeah.
But you can't, I guess over time you end up – they end up surviving. but it is an interesting point that, you know, that stands out for you as an admirable contract. Not many people would look at that.
Oh, it's totally admirable. I just think the people who are wise enough to know that a family is important to them and not take them for granted and actually give them the time and attention, probably not the time and attention they deserve, but, you know, enough to keep things ticking over and people happy and comfortable and secure, and still do the startup entrepreneurial founder thing at the same time. I just think that's amazing juggling of skills and prioritization. I think that's amazing.
What's next for you? It seems like you're redlining it. It's a pretty amazing job, as you've said, but kind of what's next? What do you look to as someone who is an achiever and is clearly going to be continuing to push yourself?
So this is the last job I'll ever have, honestly. I know that sounds bizarre and really retro. You join a business and then stay there until you retire. But it is. Like,
just hanging out for that long service leave.
You know, it's what is it? You refer to having a job more than 10 years as retro. It'll come back in fashion again at some point.
Yeah, but, like, why do I need to go anywhere else? Everything I've ever wanted to do and every new envelope I've wanted to push, I've been able to do that at Blue Sky. So I've got no need to go anywhere else. And the people I work with are so amazing that, I know it sounds like I'm just being really lame, but, like, I don't want to do anything else. But what we will do is we will scale up what we're doing. So we've got over a $200 million under management in the venture business now. Our next fund is going to be $200 million, the one we're raising right now. We'll just continue to scale up what we do, and that might mean going to new territories. So we've done two investments now in Southeast Asia. So now we have investments in the US, in Australia, in Asia. I think we'll probably do more there. And
just not traveling enough? You thought you'd add a few extra countries?
No, but this is where
picking
I was.
Areas she wants to go to and then invest in that area. Yeah.
No, I'm getting to the second point. So my focus, my personal focus, is about how do we make sure that we set up the venture industry in Australia to be sustainable? How do we continue to give investors the returns that they need or that they deserve if they're investing in a riskier class like venture capital? And the one way to do that is to expand and scale up. But the second is priority for me is how do I give the opportunity that I got to others? And, you know, we've got three people in our team, actually now four, who are all phenomenal. And, like, they're so young, but they're so good. Like, I'm so jealous of how good they are at the age that they're at. And they're going to do amazing things. So my priority is how do I give them the same opportunities to grow a business like I was given. So I'll do less traveling. They'll do more traveling. But they're all super hungry for it too. So I think that's pretty exciting.
My last question before rapid fire, which is just a series of short answer questions or questions that require short answers. I'm not sure what I'm saying. But my last question is, what an interesting job to be in and the psychology of it, that you've kind of got this ticking time bomb. It's like there's like this finite period where, and you mentioned sort of 15 years, where like, it's a project, it's a mission. And not many people have that.
Yeah, I think it's the more I read about happiness, the more I understand that it's driven by having a sense of purpose. So, and I, on the Myers-Briggs personality, I'm an INFJ, which means that I am incredibly driven by purpose. So that old story checks out. So for me, I think I've picked this business because I find a lot of purpose in my job. It's not just kind of doing a job for the sake of it. There are some amazing byproducts. I'm making investors money and helping grow the wealth of Australia. We're helping founders get their vision off the ground. We're creating jobs. Like, all of that stuff is absolutely the reason that I know I do my job. It's not the only reason, but it's one of the key drivers of it. But yes, there is a ticking time bomb. And I'm always conscious of that.
Rapid fire now?
Do I have to warm up for this?
No, you do.
We call it shit rapid fire because it's always terribly delivered by us. So my first question is, assuming you've got – he's laughing because it's always terrible.
He's actually really poor at it. That's one question.
No, I've got a couple in the bank. I don't know if you've got Spotify, but whatever you play music through on your phone, what is the last song that you listen to? And you've got your phone.
What's the last song?
Or maybe you're sitting in – like you're partway through the song right now.
And as you find it, I'll just let you know that in shit rapid fire, you're not allowed to sit on the fence for any questions.
Okay.
Just managing expectations.
Ray LaMontagne, Burn. That was the last one I'm partway through.
I had the fortune of having lunch with Paul Bassett, and he said, as investors, you're always defined by the investment you didn't make. They didn't invest in Vinomofo, and that's what he said. Yeah, he said that. That was the one example that he gave. What is one investment to this point you've knocked back that you go, oh, I know people will criticise us for that?
Canva.
Canva, that was the story of I was just thinking of the story of the 300 pitch decks that she did.
Yeah, 3 years or 2 years or something.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
The most influential person on you as a youngster?
My dad.
If you're going to play a professional sport, what would it have been?
Tennis.
Formative book that you've read.
He cuts me out. It's good.
Formative as in influential?
Yes.
To Kill a Mockingbird.
You were not in this space and not a scientist. What is it, the left field thing, job that you would love to be doing?
It's not left field, but medicine. I would love to be a doctor.
We've asked a few people this. The most euphoric Jerry Maguire, you know, just signed up, the big talent, driving home, free falling, comes on in the car. The most euphoric moment in your business life.
Right. Good question.
Where you've thought, let's just get pissed now. This is amazing. That kind of, you know.
That's such a jock sentence you just delivered.
You know what I mean?
Oh, it's most weeks. probably when my first exit, actually, as a venture capitalist.
Come on, give me one more.
What podcasts do you listen to, if any?
I listen to a lot. So Will Anderson, Philosophy, Tim Ferriss, Rob Wolf, because I'm super into ancestral health. I've got my podcast here. I can go through them a lot. Like, I love
And on the
podcasts.
Plane, that's when or
– So yeah. On the plane, I'll either write blogs, listen to podcasts, listen to music, or do work.
The one, like, kind of typical startup formula piece of advice actually that you disagree with. So, for instance, Paul Bassett said, bring on partners who you like, not just strategic partners. In other words, he was sort of saying, look, you know, strategy's great, you know, it all fits, but just get someone you like.
Mm. What bit of advice do I disagree with? That you actually have to raise money. A lot of people can do it by bootstrapping.
Most awkward moment that has occurred for you in a founder pitch type of meeting?
Awkward or like just weird?
Yeah, like weird's you better.
There are so many awkwards where, for example, we ask questions, like I'll ask a guy a question and then he'll answer to all the guys in the room.
Still happens?
Oh, like weekly. Yeah.
Kidding.
Yeah. But the weirdest one was a couple of weeks ago and there was the CEO and the head of sales, and the CEO was trying to be super congratulatory of his sales group and the work that they had done, and he called them gladiators because of the kind of amount of work they'd put into it. And the head of sales said, "I don't see myself as a gladiator. I see myself as a hunter. Not because I want to hunt, but because I, not because I need to hunt, but because I want to hunt. I like the taste of blood."
What?
Took me just a little far. How did you react? Like, in like your role, do you have to keep a straight face?
He said that, and I said, that is now going to be the most memorable thing anyone has ever said to me in a pitch. Yeah.
Okay, my last question for rapid fire is that if you're going to invest in an industry that you haven't yet, what would it be?
So one that we haven't invested in, which I think we should look harder at, but I don't understand it, is blockchain and cryptocurrency. Yeah. Like, I feel like we should be looking at it harder than we are. It's not to say we will, but yeah.
It seems like it's either, it's a bubble, let's just not even talk about it, or it's going to change the entire world and nothing in between.
Yeah, and I think I can understand most concepts, like if I try. But I still can't wrap my head around this. I'd love to see someone write something if anyone's listening to this podcast, if they want to send through something that will make it easier for the layperson to understand whether there is some real fundamental drivers that are sitting underneath this amazing price surge that we've seen, or if it's really just a bubble. I'd love to read more about it.
I want it described in like a pictogram. It needs to be that basic.
I'd totally be into that too.
Elaine, thank you for coming on to Rooster Radio. It's been an amazing more than an hour, and really appreciate in what is an incredibly hectic schedule in squeezing in a little Adelaide podcast, but we've really enjoyed it, and thank you again.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to our interview with Dr. Elaine Stead. We have plenty of interesting interviews in the bank and many more to come, so subscribe to Rooster Radio, and if you like what we're doing, leave us a review in iTunes. And connect with us at roosterradio.biz. We'd love to hear from you.